I thought we could start with, your parents have had an intercaste marriage. I was trying to understand like implications of that, in the sense, sometimes I feel partly it may be overblown as well. Like, I don't know, in like day-to-day life, how much people think about, you know, my dad is a Muslim or my mom is a Sikh or whatever. I'm not sure how much of a role that plays. Maybe in retrospect, people do tend to exaggerate these things. But I don't know, because both my parents are of the same religion. So maybe I don't know anything that I'm talking about. So if you could shed light on that, maybe a little bit on how do you think about it? How much of a role that has played?
So it's a very valid question to ask about concern also on, are we kind of overblowing the personal identity question? And that's very legit to ask that do we kind of overemphasize on our where our parents hailed from, which area we come from, etc. But I think very memorably, as I think Amartya Sen in his book on identity points out very interestingly, that when he's in a village somewhere and he's being asked where are you from, then he says, I'm from block number such and such or post office number such and such. When you're on the state, you say, I am from that village. I am from wherever, Eluru or Dhanbad. In that state, you point out the district. If you're asked that in the country, you point out which state you come from. And if you're in the US, you say, I am from India or Bhutan or whatever. So I think there is a need, therefore, for human beings to kind of identify to, roots, origins, homeland, a lot has been said about it. Though I think Sam Miller's latest book, Migrations, puts paid to that and says human beings are actually just wandering creatures, you know, as much as rhinos, monkeys, and people are, that they swing from tree to tree and they seek to go out of themselves as well. So I think identity is very complex. But coming back very specifically to me and my identity, the fact that my father was a Muslim from North India, my mother was a Hindu from South India, there were many levels of the kind of differences. So there's religion, there is a caste, there is a language, there is region, there is also, class maybe, there is also but completely different kinds of families. It was where two people in 64 kind of chose each other and got married. So that's a very, so it was not as if nobody was doing that, but it was a very kind of a very interesting kind of coincidence that it was like that. And I was their only child. So because, and I think you're right when you say that maybe because your parents are of the similar religion, because we have this question, a lot of caste questions, that a lot of the upper caste say that caste doesn't matter because it's never mattered to me kind of thing. So I think for people with different faiths, etc., it sometimes becomes important to reflect on this, partly because society, immediate social circles are curious about, are you, how would you bring up your child? And are you a Hindu or are you a Muslim? How were you brought up? Partly those questions. And then the larger concentric circle of politics. So I think the reason why I just put out a short memoir, if you like to call it, or a story of my parents' marriage, the initial years, that is more prompted by, I think, the politics we found ourselves in, where the emphasis on identity, surnames, last name, who you are, seem to make all the difference in how anybody would be perceived, not only me. And I found myself at a very interesting kind of a fault line. I was almost straddling that, not as a fault line, but as a stitch, as something that was stitching me together. So I thought it was a nice piece of me, a slice of me to put out into the world, and to actually throw it out as a provocative question of what it was like to be brought up by people of two religions, two completely different identities, which there is a debate to kind of make them to be at war at all times. Like everything that should spell fusion is being seen as a point of contestation. So for me, whether it's Hubli, whether it's even Ayodhya, whether it's a Mandir and Masjid, whether it is any of these other places or Ajmer, for me, that's the point of ultimate confluence, right? If you and I both believe in something, it should bring us together rather than result in a fight, where we decide to split the spoils. So, that's all of these questions were hovering around me in a very urgent sort of way. And I thought I should just put it out by a very personal story, which is just very much a part of me.
So I think, was the religious identity was like when you were trying to, like everybody tries to figure out their identity, right? In the sense like who they are or, what do they want to do? I mean, I'm sort of framing the identity question with like whatever you want to do in life question plus like other self-actualization questions. Was yours like kind of dominated by You know, the first question I asked in this, I mean, I could have spoken about any other thing, but, you know, I went to this, your parents and your, what is that, your parents' marriage of like different castes. So that's kind of that, like, I was kind of attracted by those questions than any other work that you might have done. So do you feel like that's unfair in the sense that, you know, a lot of when people look at you or they talk about you, that's the first thing that they might think of, or it's that conversation might have dominated your way of people looking at you? I don't know. Does that make sense?
No, I don't think so. I give people a lot of leeway in what they think about the other person. It's their call, you know. If I was called Rita Faria, maybe they've thought of me differently. So people put a lot. There's plenty in a name. Shakespeare would have never said that had he been Indian, you know. There is so much in a name in our country, you know. We put postcode in our names. We are, you know, what's in a name is so important. What's your naam kya hai? You know, tell me your surname. This is such a thing we hear in trains. I am also probably judging people by which part of the country are they from, you know. How do they spell it? Why have they put three A's in their name? So I don't mind that. Secondly, this thing about, no, I don't think so. I think it just proves my point about identity being something very, very center stage now by how you said that you looked at me. But maybe people look at that also because maybe Google's throwing up stupid things after I wrote this book. So that's fine. No, it didn't really dominate me. It formed me. It formed me in a way where it was kind of like the dough is kneaded into the like pizza, but it's not always kind of there. So sure, it's my base of my pizza on which I choose to put other toppings. So it's like a given. It's my set of cards. But no, not it's not something that's haunted me or dominated me or I'm angry about it. No, far from it.
I don't know if you have gone on to do like an intercaste marriage or no, but that's not the question. But what I'm trying to get at is, but you have at least seen the outcome of intercaste marriage, which is by intercaste or interreligion. I don't know, man. Anyways, which is
just
a little different.
Just intermarriage.
I'm curious whether you think these intermarriages are worth it. I mean, yeah, like in a sense, is it worth all the quote-unquote drama, I don't know, or the questions?
No, I want you to find the word for that. Worth what? Worth the time or worth the drama? That word you choose will be important.
I'll tell you what I'm... Like, my sentiment of that question is, like, is it worth, like, I mean...
Why bother, you mean?
Is it worth going through that, or, you know, just saying, you know, I don't want to go through this, man. You're amazing, but, you know, I'm sure if I wait 10 more months, I'll find someone.
Let me get married to who my dad picked, huh? Why bother? Is that the question?
Maybe not my dad picked, but I'm sure even I can, like, I'm also good looking. I can also probably find somebody who's as good looking as you, or maybe as, you know, personality wise also, and probably like all things considered, probably I can do better, or even if I won't do so much worse. So is it worth all that, or, you know?
So there are various ways in which I can answer this question. First things, I have my thoughts about marriage, which are not entirely complementary to the institution of marriage. So I don't think it is like a thing that, anyway, you know, whether one should get married or not is like another question. You know, why do we get married? Do we, like, we're just pushing through the institution of private property or to decide on legitimacy of children? Or you and I can be friends since we're children, but we don't. And I'm so loyal to my friends, as are my friends to me. We've never signed a document saying we'll always be loyal. So why in this marriage thing are we contracting it? Are we, hey guys, property aisa, this, that, and the other, etc. So I have my opinions on marriage. So, but, you know, but why I can't be without, though I'm married, but why should it need a marriage to make me live with my partner? So I think it's a very, very overrated kind of idea. And it's something which is responsible for a lot of subjugation. It is a theater for a lot of oppression,
Legally, it'll make a lot of sense. No, you don't think so?
Legally, it makes a lot of sense. That's why one gets married. But socially as well, acceptance. Chacha, married, then it's okay. You know, otherwise you can't be seen. So I agree. You accord respect, etc. So I'm married. I've walked into that framework. All I'm saying is that now that I reflect back nearly 2.5 decades on, that I, you know, it's like a highly overrated kind of a thing, marriage. So anyway, that put aside, I'm a romantic in terms of, you know, I put a high premium on love. And this is something which VP Singh, I think, had said or written in his memoirs, very good one. He said that's the only decision human beings actually take for themselves. You are born into a certain family. you don't decide your mom, your dad, your cousins, your everything. The only thing you'd probably decide is your life partner. So I'd hold on to that decision. I'd like it to. And too much trouble means what, yeah? Then we'd be doing everything. It's much less trouble to continue beating your wife, or it's much less trouble to subscribe to all the social regression. So there'll be no change then if I was to say that, is it worth all the trouble? Oh, sure, man. But love is worth all possible trouble that you can go through. Companionship, mutual regard, building a space together. So I'd do anything for love, to quote many sort of singers. And I'd respect people who did that. So I am what you may call a romantic. But, you know, I'd be damned if I said, ki, you know, you're great, but I'll find somebody who's 5'8", who's like good looking, who has a bigger salary. That sucks for me, frankly. I judge people who do that.
So I actually disagree with that, in the sense that...
I'm sure, yeah. A lot of people do. Well, most of India does.
I don't think so. I don't think... No. I think most of India is with you. I don't think that's...
They watch Shah Rukh Khan in a film. They will marry who mummy and daddy say. They'll watch Shah Rukh, they'll watch Kareena, but they will marry
that's
who
they're... because they're not able to find anyone from of their own, right? Like, I mean,
that could be true, but I don't... You've read Rukmini's book, right? Where she says, when she's going... she says that interreligious marriages are such a low percentage, like me, that they're only 2% or so, of which historically, they've really been very, very low. But the guys tell her that, ma'am, you're asking the wrong question. You should ask love, not about marriage. It is much higher. So... I think you need to seek out, yeah, and break this. You need to break your shackles and step out, because by that logic, we would still be in the Stone Ages. We would never believe that the earth revolves around the sun, by which we would never believe all human beings are equal. No progress is possible unless you slap a few people and break shackles. That's my view.
I actually didn't understand the logic from intermarriage to like Stone Age, but... I'm gonna let that one slide.
Because I'll explain that. But Stone Age, I mean, is a prescribed module. You're in a stencil. Ki boss, this is it. This will be chosen. Your life partner will be chosen for your good by somebody else who's taking away your agency to do that. So then you continue to be in a particular kind of a social framework, and that impacts.
No, I disagree with the base only. No, like, I mean, you're making. I feel like you're making the assumption that like. Like, everybody's life partner is chosen by their parents. But, like, I don't think, first of all, that is true, in the sense...
But you posited the choice between a problematic kind of a self-agency-driven thing which could work against social, conditions versus something. So that's why I posited it as between two extremes. A full choice, which is going against all social things, and then, parental choice. But you're right, that if you can't find anybody and all, that's all different. Yeah. That's also the sex ratio, yeah. I agree, and opportunities and that whole incel thing. Yes, sure. That's real.
Okay. But I want to go back to the, like, but you, just to push on the, just to conclude on the, what is that? Like, on a romantic, like, what I'm reminded of is, I don't know if you watched the Life in a Metro movie.
No, did it have lots of like vignette
things? Yeah, it was multiple storylines. I don't. This may not be a good example, but anyways. So in the movie, Shilpa Shetty ends up having an affair with. Shilpa Shetty is in an unhappy marriage, and then she ends up having an affair with somebody else, obviously. And there, obviously, in the movie, the portrayal is such that Shilpa Shetty is obviously in love. Massively in love with this person, but she already has a family and a kid, but you know, she doesn't take the dive to like, you know, maybe move away from the marriage. So I don't know where I was going with this, but I think my point was, like, you know, sometimes even if you do like somebody a lot, you know, it's yeah. So now what I'm trying to get at is, sometimes it's not worth it, right? Like, I mean, so she decides that the cost of like maybe leaving that that life aside, probably, and this movie came out in 2007. So she makes the decision that, you know, it's really not worth it. I like the guy. I'll probably be happier with the guy. But what my neighbor thinks of me is much more important than the happiness that I will probably get. So idealistically wise, I don't know, I can maybe I can sympathize with your argument, or intellectually I can sympathize with your argument, but practically I feel a lot of people might make that decision of like, it's really not worth it. Let me just, you know.
I have no disagreement with what you're saying. The majority would probably do that. And some, I mean, I thought you were going to say, I hope Shilpa Shetty, I hope the director was better and she goes back because she finds a reservoir of love in her marriage, which is superior to what she feels for this other person. That's okay. But she's going back because of what the neighbor thinks. I mean, to paraphrase love thy neighbor, I mean, please ignore thy neighbor. So that's what, I mean, I understand what you're saying that people do it. I have no, you know, I'm not like an, I know people do it, but I don't know if I would advocate that. So that's like, and in any case, this is different. There are many other multiple questions involved. If there's a previous marriage, a relationship involved.
Yeah, yeah. That's right.
Which is fine. But I think if there's a gay, if there's somebody who's gay, who's been forced into a marriage and comes out and all, I'm not going to judge that person. Yeah. I'm not, I'm going to judge a world which has forced the person to kind of stay within a cis kind of boundary. So, yeah, that's what I'm saying. So, of course, I mean, it's perfectly understandable and people do that. But it's not my preferred mode of operating. I mean, to tell people that please listen to what your neighbor is saying. Neighbors say lots of things. They have all kinds of opinions. I disagree on everything my neighbor says. Why would I agree on what the RWA says about how I should live? So, yeah. Anyway.
Understood. Yeah. Sorry, so one feedback which I have is if you can maybe... your
headphones?
Laptop. If you can just maybe... Your half of your face is not visible, actually.
Better?
Better, yeah. Sorry. I just want to push on... I just want to keep pushing a little bit on the intermarriage part, finally. So has that made you... Has that made you more adventurous maybe in your love life at all?
Well, it was very difficult to marry somebody from my same caste, which would be interreligious and all that. So I've married people who are not of the same caste. I mean, they have come, you know, their parents were of the same caste, as it were. So adventurous in the sense, yeah, it kind of gave me a different idea about what a love is and what life is and what a love life is, etc. No doubt. But also, it kind of set a very high bar for me. And I think that kind of did kind of... work to my detriment sometimes of it set a very high bar on what a good relationship should be, what it involves being together, how much space you give to each other, etc. So, but that may not have been reasons of my parents being an intercaste, interreligious. That was one factor. But about how much you kind of just give and allow the other person to flower in terms of that. So, yeah, it did set a high bar that way. So, sure, it did impact on how I viewed relationships or even friends and intimate relationships, and of course in my marriage.
I want to close this chapter on maybe love and
yes, we should get back to hate, which is the more dominant chapter in 2023. Yeah, go on.
Want to move on to journalism maybe. So could you paint a picture as to so you have worked so from here, I think we'll be jumping. I won't follow chronology per se, so we'll jump a little from you know, we'll jump a lot, so don't mind. So before we get started, just could you paint a picture as to why is journalism important? Like, why do people need to care about journalism? And like, along with that, if you can maybe weave that into your story of like why, like what you could have done multiple things. You seem very smart, so you could have gone to multiple careers as well. So, like, why did you choose, and has it been worth it?
Three questions there. I'll answer. I try and sequence my answers. First, on the importance of journalism. The way I see it, there's probably nothing more important than journalism to make the wheels of history, society, or humanity kind of move. Because I'm defining journalism as most broadly defined, in terms of being able to analyze society, in terms of being able to see what's happening, to record keep on what is actually happening, what should happen, in terms of joining the dots on what all that's happening, in terms of storytelling, in terms of bearing witness for what we experience, feel, what's going on. So for me, journalism is at its very basic, a very important glue of what binds or brings people together. Imagine a place where we just would not hear of any other story or be able to connect with somebody or to do anything. It would be a very, very kind of a different, crazy, lonely kind of place. So for me, journalism is a very important way of record keeping for the future, for the present, and for enabling people to find themselves. For example, a small story. Supposing journalism around unemployment was to disappear. which it almost has, but supposing nobody talks about unemployment, I have an unemployed son and a daughter-in-law or a mother, you know. I'm constantly saying that it's my bad luck that I have these losers who are related to me who can't find a job. It takes journalism or somebody to tell me the larger story. And I say, no, hold on. There are so many people being laid off here. This is the state of the planet. This is the state of play here. So I'm able to find perspective to that. So, I mean, that this is a very trivial example, but for everything, I think journalism is critical and is very, very central to stuff. I also view people who, I look at all academic work and I find it really funny that some of the most highfalutin academic world in work in language, which you and I will take hours decoding, you go to the index and you go to the bibliography and you'll find page 3 of the Hindu or the Statesman, a small news item is the start of that. So this is like that Truman Capote thing, right? So, I mean, it's like basically somebody bothered enough to tell a story which was someone else's story, but they told that story and they put it out in the public domain in a decent way that has consequences. So I'm a fan of those consequences. I want those consequences to kick in because that's what makes us as a species interesting and unique and special. So I think journalism is like really important. As far as I am concerned, maybe because my father was a journalist, that may have played a role. But I remember very, very vividly, I think it was class 8, there was a lot of pressure on me to actually become, to be a person who does fundamental science, etc. I didn't even do science in school. I quit it after the 10th. I was a liberal arts person with maths. And I remember the science teacher was so angry with me when she was signing something. My physics teacher, Mrs. Rana, I remember, and she was like, "You people just want to earn money." I'm like, no, I don't earn any money. And at that time, not journalism, but she thought I was doing eco and all that. I said, no, but I just think economy. I used to love eco. Again, my mom, economist, maybe that played. This is all hindsight. At that time, I was, of course, defying everyone. So, and she just gave me a mouthful that people like you should be going into fundamental science and that's what we need. I said, I don't want to do fundamental science. And I remember the inside of an iron was being explained by the physics teacher. And I decided that, boss, none of this is for me. I'm not being locked up in a lab or, dissecting frogs. In my time, we actually dissected dead frogs. But I'm going to be a kind of a journalist, which does everything. So I was very happy and I decided quite early that I will be a journalist we are all at the cusp of before it became a very paying profession. That was a time when Hindi movies and other movies portrayed journalists with kurtas and jeans and smoking and, with slippers that kind of broke. It was a completely different kind of journalist at that time. It's almost like a Prabhash Joshi idea of journalism or the kind of, it was a revolutionary as journalist. And I was always mindful of the fact that whether it was Gandhi or Nehru or a whole lot of others, I mean, even Jinnah, for heaven's sake, they needed a newspaper to make their cause. So I was also socially conscious, if you like to call it that. So to do my bit of good in the world, I thought I should be a journalist and tell good stories. How has it worked out? I don't know how would it have worked out if I was a banker or something, or a salesman, or a waiting tables in a restaurant. But I think I'm good being a journalist because I get a feeling that I've kind of been able to keep up with all my several interests in a way that I used to sing at some point, but I would be damned if I was to become a singer or a musician. I would not have that kind of dedication. I can read for 6 hours at a stretch. I can write for 7 hours at a stretch, but I don't know if I can do any other thing. So it's my own kind of inclination as well that brought me. I think it's fine. And lives can be lived in multiple ways. So no doubt, but no regrets. Great. I'm happy that I picked what I did. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, of course. So you were good in science and yet you still, ended up doing arts. Is that why your teacher was pissed?
Yeah, she was. But I mean, I was good in science because I'm the sort of person who'd be good with anything you gave me. I could drill a hole in the wall reasonably because I would bother about getting the measurements right and all. So that was like it's a thing that I do, but I didn't want, oh God, like I have to like clear this paper and do decently in this. So I did it. But I was good in certain areas because I cared passionately enough. And I was, I think, maybe mature enough, or I was just conscious enough, not mature enough. I was conscious enough to know the difference. To know the difference between me in a history class, me in an English literature, Hindi literature class, compared to me in a science class. So, yeah, I mean, she was angry. Maybe she told a whole lot of others also. What the hell are you guys doing in the eco bunch? Take up physics.
Like another thing you mentioned, which I was a little surprised by, was you spoke about at that point you were defying everyone. I don't know if you remember that. Remember you saying that in your answer, but that I found that like very contra- like very very not true, in the sense like
maybe that was my impression as a youngster. I was, yeah, but I didn't think of that I'm heading to, so I didn't want to be an economist.
But you okay.
But I was speaking, I was not conscious of that. So I mean, that's how your identity also binds you in certain ways, no? But at that time, I was just doing something. I was defying Mrs. Rana, at least. I was defying school because of the bright kids. Like, who goes to, I mean, please, you know, we were the C-section, and the chaps who are in our class, I mean, for the boys particularly to do arts was like, oh God, like what? Chishti is like in arts now. Okay, that kind of thing. So in that kind of framework of, imagine this is like early 80s. It's a different kind of a, you know, science and all is the thing to do. You know, doctor or engineer, which of the two are you? In our times, it was very, very circumscribed. You didn't want to be a fashion designer at that time or want to be something else. You either were a doctor or an engineer, you know, if you were reasonably making the grades, which I was. So, yeah, so that was defiance in that very narrow one. Or maybe I just kind of, you know, saw myself as more defiant than I was. But you're right, in retrospect, maybe I was... You know, I was kind of playing to another drumbeat of not being defined.
So, journalism, I don't think I have any friends who are journalists. But the sense that, but the sense that I do.
That's a lovely statement. I don't know anybody who said that to me. Narrow social circle of mine. Yes, go on.
But the sense that I do get from like maybe some assumptions that I've made is like I think there is some sort of like I'm doing this for a good cause, or you know, this is a noble profession per se. Like at least I do get that vibe. Is that? I mean, if that is true, and if you had made that assumption. Did that turn out to be like a accurate one, or you can speak to your own assumptions that you made and maybe talk about what did they turn out to be accurate or no?
Yes and no. Sometimes I look at bits and pieces of what I've done and I feel genuinely kind of good about them. So I may have been the kernel or the start of several debates around it, which had big consequences on some things. So I'm happy about some stuff I did, but surely, no. I mean, you know, I really wish I was more radical and I had stepped out on my own much earlier. I wish I had the resources to do my own kind of thing, my own kind of supremely pristine, proper, good journalism, which is actually, as you're saying, a social good. No doubt. No, I didn't do that. So I've worked for a salary for so long. It did matter that, as I said, I was on the cusp. I started work in 1990. And that is a cusp when salaries are runaway salaries for journalists. You know, they're earning so much. So yes, we are all also in that trap of wanting. I'm very much a victim of being a part of that generation, which put on the side the business of really helping society. We left it to other people, invisible other people, including politicians. And, you know, like political parties will take care of that. We'll fix the world or whatever. Some activists will. Our job is different. So, no, there are lots of issues with not at all kind of came true. All of that, what you're saying, in some parts, no doubt we... I did some stuff which I can feel kind of triggered the debate, added to the knowledge on human planet, and it triggered some things deeper than what they would have been had that been absent. But no, it's no, by no doubt is it like a perfect thing of social good that I did. Far from it.
I'm actually completely confused, actually.
Why?
In the sense, so you were the deputy editor of the Indian Express, if I'm not wrong. And now you're serving as the editor of The Wire. And if you're saying that you have not done any radical work, like, I don't know, like, what
I others... It speaks of the landscape, yeah. I mean, it should have been much more radical. No, I should, somebody with... if I'm claiming to be, like, for radical work and all, I should have just much... I became the editor of The Wire like 6-7 months ago. No doubt it's like a great place. And it's a very unique journalism model because it's founded by journalists. It's not like, you know, there is no kind of corporate house or a Lala, etc. It's journalists have founded it, which is not the case with several other legacy media, as it were. But no, I should have been much more radical. There's so much more to be done. I mean, look at the world, look at India. I mean, please. to think that, you know, deputy editor, Indian Express or editor, why, oh, there's so much unfinished business. I could have done so much more. So, oh, there is no question about it.
Okay, okay. I want to continue on the thread of the editor. So I feel editor, being an editor is like the pinnacle of the industry. Like, I mean, I feel a lot of people who might get into journalism might want to serve one day as being the editor of a publication. It's a very coveted position, in my opinion. And it's also because of the scarcity of the positions itself. There are only so many newspapers or publications to go around, and there are only so many editors to go around, obviously. So the scarcity of it, even though the position might be useless, I mean, the scarcity of it will give it a lot of esteem and a lot of prestige to the position, to the person having that position. So is that fair? Like, I mean, in the sense that it is it the pinnacle of the journalism world? Yeah, what is it like being, I don't know, is the aura around the position overblown, or I don't know, is it not?
So there is a big debate in kind of journalism about, you know, between the desk and the reporting, in any case, so the guys who get the story and the people who weave it, shape it, stitch it and put it, push the boat out to sea. Like, you know, who really is the heart of it? So I have been actually an editor much less than I have been a reporter, writer, as it were. Even when I was deputy editor at Indian Express, and I must thank my chief editor and my, you know, the editor at that time, that my fundamental job was to like go out, get stories and write. So I was able to stay an editor, sorry, a reporter, a writer, much more than I was fixing copies, seeing things and overseeing and all that. So one should never overblow anything. But I don't know if the pinnacle, if it's correct, as it is in a lot of ways, to treat the editor as the apogee of the whole journalistic kind of career experience. I don't think that should happen, because if you look at somebody like Mark Tully, I was in the BBC at that time, and it was very interesting how they tried to bump him up by making him bureau chief, which is like an editor, if you like, because his strength was in driving stories, bringing them together. He'd probably fail miserably as a chief of bureau. Not Mark himself, but a lot of people would fail because that's like, also a lot of it is management, marshalling egos, putting egos together, driving egos to make a story work, etc. So it needs a different set of skills being an editor. So I think one should not look at it. I mean, if this is going out to younger journalists and all, being an editor may seem like a very, it is a very powerful position. It does give you power to spike a story, to run a story, to shape a story. But it's not the only thing. You know, it'll also depend on the raw material that I have. If my wood is bad, then what kind of a chair can I help craft with it? So I think the editor is no doubt a powerful position, but it should not be seen as the apogee or the only route to a successful journey as a journalist, because I think to be a John Pilger or to be a Robert Fisk, to be John Simpson, you know, so he's called editor of Foreign Affairs because they want to give him that kind of, you know, respectability and all that. He's essentially going out and like telling stories, go out on the field. He's wearing that battle gear. That's critical. The reporter is, I'd be nobody if I had like a bunch of useless reporters or no reporters. I mean, an editor alone in the newsroom can't do much, but maybe a whole bunch of reporters can. So yeah, so it's like a bit of both, but no doubt a good editor can do a lot. You can see what they call, it's like, as they say, invisible kind of thumbprints or fingerprints on the papers, on the pages of a newspaper are the editors. You can kind of see, it's like the invisible hand, as it were. You know, you can see that if the byline of the editor is not there. Several reporters will send their stories to certain editors because they know that they will be able to juice the story out, put it in the most influential, craft it well. So I think it needs a bit of work. So there is no kind of disparaging the role of the editor away from the status. Forget the status question. But it's just in terms of power to represent a story best is done by the editor. But it can't happen without good journalistic storytelling. So I think journalists have to like choose paths. Do they want to? And there are some people who are not good at, they don't like meeting people and all that. They like shaping stories. They like, there are, you know, they now newspapers are not much talked about, but they like shaping a page. They like to craft, The Economist, the Financial Times spent so much money and time in just carving a page. How should this page look? That's a different, that's an editor would do that. A journalist will say like, I've just given you my story, now do this. You know, please fix this. to fix the loop. So I think it's a tango. It takes a minimum of two people, a reporter and the editor.
When you had to settle into the role of the editor at The Wire, you were deputy. I don't think that was your first position as the editor. No, I think previously
no,
you were
I was
deputy
editor of BBC. BBC. I was editor of the India thing in BBC World Service Radio.
But so that was back in 92, right?
No. Then I was a cub reporter, almost. This was in 2001 or so. 2001, I was kind of managing a team in BBC World Service Delhi. Yeah, till about 2006, I did that. 2006 is when I joined The Express. And then I was resident editor, deputy editor, yeah. And then Wire. Yeah.
So in that sense, I don't think... initially, I wanted to know if you had to make any preparations for the role or were you just ready at day one?
Well, I have to prepare every day. Every day in the morning, you need to like... And get into that role because other people see you in a particular way. So not that I'm role-playing, but there are certain things that I could say as a... You know, I'm speaking to journalists who are 20 years younger, who are very talented maybe, but... to how to kind of do give them the right metered kind of a brief to go out and look for a story where I'm not allowing my prejudices to come out, my own biases, allow them to kind of assert themselves, give them maximum agency, and yet be in a position to direct and allow my thoughts or whatever I'm supposed to do, my job, my duty as an editor to come through. So almost, yeah, no, one is never ready as an editor, especially if you have been a reporter-editor, then you have to be, it's a good thing at one point and it's also a bad thing at one point because temptation may be like, sort that, I'll fix it for you. I'll call or I'll get somebody else to call that person. How to rein that in and allow a maximum flowering of a news report or a news story. Which I don't have the benefit of being a first-hand witness to because I'm an editor. I'm once removed from it now. So that's like a decision you make every day. Sorry.
So at this point, you must... is it like yours is mostly at this point, it's a desk job, is it? I'm not saying it like badly.
No. But I think the big advantage of being with A, The Wire, and B, being digital and being 24 hours is far from a desk job. A lot of it does involve pounding the keyboards. That's a lot of it. But I have to kind of be speaking to people, talking to people to know that I'm getting the right story. And a lot of like younger journalists have come and say that this is what we get. Do you think that this chimes? So I'm having to do a lot of that second thing. In fact, I'm just in the middle of that in a story which I cannot discuss right now, but of just having to be able to provide that other counterfoil. So no. Those days were probably the days that we see in Citizen Kane of the smoke-filled newsrooms and the pipe-smoking elderly white man who would just say like spiked or in or out and all. I think those days are gone. At that time, an editor was also like a very, very good publisher, if you like, on a daily basis. I think now, because we have smaller newsrooms, I don't have like a layer of people who will... It's just like one or two of us who have to then kind of set the story out to sea, which will be digital. It will be in the open space, accessible. We don't have paywalls, accessible to everyone. So we have to exercise maximum responsibility with the maximum boldness to do it, to be really sharp, because I'm not running an in-flight magazine. There's a reason why people would come to Wire, because they'd expect me to take a position to... How do you do that in the most judicious of ways? No. I wish I didn't have to speak to so many people, but I have to speak to a lot of people. So no, it's not desk that way. There is a lot of desk work involved, but it just means you have to put in more hours. You have to, because you have to keep the balance right of how much you kind of speak and how much you desk. Sorry.
So no smoking and all inside the office and all, is it that
arises? No smoking inside the office. No drinking also. So this is mythology of editors and all having whiskey in their desk drawers and also. All that is over. But that died in the 90s, I think. With the whole corporatization of journalism, like you can't have like swigs of whiskey if you're working, and even ITC or whatever, even in Diageo, you can't do that in journalism.
Your position, I think as you alluded to earlier, I think you explicitly spoke about, your position also comes with a lot of power. You're obviously, I would say, a powerful person. Probably the most powerful person I've spoken to. I don't know. Maybe not, but yeah.
don't think so. I looked at your list. Yeah, I don't see myself in a great position of power. But anyway, go on.
Okay. I don't want to flatter you. Anyways, okay. Do you think about that, like, on a daily? I don't think so. But now and then, when you have to press that enter button, or I don't know which button you press for, like, publishing the story or giving a sign off, it's like, oh my God, this is going to, like, probably make a difference. Difference in the sense, it's going to shape public opinion, or it's going to have some ripple effects in the culture, in pop culture, or in, like, day-to-day life of a few people. Only, like, I can think of only a few professions that can do that. Like, if I'm a customer, if I'm doing customer support as my job, like, obviously, I'm reaching out to a few people, but that really does not do any impact on, like, pop culture or, like, so... In that spectrum, you obviously hold like a decent amount of power. How do you think about that? Is there some practices that you might do that, you know, to curtail your inner power hungry or whatever?
Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't see myself as really powerful. I'm like learning all the time. Also, our kind of political environment being such, a lot of people think we are the most vulnerable. So they seem to think of journalism as an act of bravery. So we're not very powerful. There was a time when, you know, journalists could ring up people and say, do this, that, and the other, and all that. So I think that kind of phase is not relevant now. Journalists have given up a lot of their power. Power as commonly understood. But I think that point that you make is like really powerful. And that speaks to me. That thrill we feel, that slight moment of trepidation before we hit enter, we do actually return. It is, yeah, to say, right, it's gone. And that minutes, I think just that minutes before it's published is a great feeling of thrilled, this kind of bowlers run up and all that. And of course, when it's published, there is like a kick that you, so those highs are there. It's a very kind of adrenaline prone profession. It has the opposite side of adrenaline as well, but it just like, you know, sets the whole newsroom abuzz that, oh, it's published, it's gone, it's up on air. You know, and someone shares it, somebody responds to it. So yeah, that is to quote Spider-Man, quoted many times, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. So I don't see it as great power, but no doubt as responsibility and certain amount of power. I mean, I tweeted about this also, but I was like really struck by... Christopher Nolan kind of picking Oppenheimer at a time like this, and it has triggered a long piece in The New Yorker. I was reading something in Foreign Policy, and they're actually going back to talk about the nuclear bomb. So, you know, we've never had as many nuclear warheads out loose in the world without an active treaty between Russia and America as we do now. We keep talking casually at the cusp of a Cold War between US and China as to how dangerous the situation is without people being cognizant of nuclear power as a big deal, as an unusable no-go thing. There was this whole thing, not like, and they've actually, I think they've turned we're like 90 seconds closer to, or 90 seconds away from Armageddon, that nuclear clock. So I was just thinking about how an act of popular cinema has just driven the conversation there. And especially yesterday, as I sat through the film, it's a long 3-hour film. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's like it should be seen. So as an act of documentation, as an act of very nicely putting this out, I was thinking how Nolan would have felt about portraying Oppenheimer he's taken a very interesting, but that must have been a point of great thing for him as well. You know, is he a good guy, very bright man? Or is he the guy who gave us Los Alamos and the big bomb, and he gave us Hiroshima? So, and he's dealt with that at a time like this. So I was thinking of the power of popular culture, and I think, yeah, you're right, journalism falls into that spectrum somewhere of wielding a teeny weeny bit of agency or triggering things. So yeah, we are conscious of that little teeny weeny role that we play. And yeah, and the point is to always try and kind of amplify that for the good cause, but the risk of doing something completely opposite or of not mattering at all, that does, all these thoughts do come to your head. I'm very conscious of it all the time.
I want to take one digression here. I have made the case with a few of my friends that I'm sure you're familiar with Sam Altman.
Yeah.
I have made the case with a few of my friends that Sam Altman is the Oppenheimer of our age, and he might go down in history. Like, I will not be shocked if in like 50 years we'll see a movie about Sam Altman. do you agree with my thesis, or no, do you think?
No, I think that's a good one, because a lot of people are saying that we should not allow another Zuckerberg. My only point of variance here is that, you know, Oppenheimer was a scientist. Sam Altman, to me, and I think that's where we're at a very difficult point now, and this is something to which this absolutely wonderful person called Meredith Whitaker kind of alerted me to. She's the president of Signal. She's a tech worker. She describes herself as a tech worker, and she's a very profound thinker. She's a philosopher on technology. She's written on Charles Babbage. She has her views on dead labor. And to find a person like that at the cutting edge of social, digital is a real treat. So listening to her was beautiful. I proposed this to her at RightsCon in June, last month, we're heading towards extinction. Sam Altman and seven of his friends said that, this is so powerful, artificial intelligence. I think there's like a large part of this whole corporate shit that's playing here. So in the same way that I won't hold Zuckerberg and Steve Jobs as equal to scientists of the net world, so... they are the corporate kind of shapers of destinies in ways which are very different from how Oppenheimer did or Einstein did, because they were dealing with the thing of science in themselves. So I know what you're saying, that Sam Altman may be at the cusp of that whole thing about just sending humanity running down a different road. But Meredith, coming back to Meredith, what she said very clearly was to call it artificial intelligence itself is a mistake. This, it should be LLMs. It should be kind of a probability, statistical probability at best. It's a probability exercise, because she says two things make it possible. Because when I was asking her about, can it not be controlled? Is it the genie has left the bottle? There are these magical qualities we ascribe to tech, right? I mean, she was profound, and I think that's really stayed with me. So I'll share it with you. She says there are two things here. Of course, it can be controlled. It so depends on surveillance data. If it didn't have access to large volumes of data that it picks up by consent or by deceit or by not getting people to consent, AI is not possible, because it's essentially data which is allowing it to train itself. Number two, she said, the monopolies that these are, they're just the economic monopoly, that they're such large behemoths that they can afford to run these things, that they can afford to be here. If you break up these conglomerates, we're on a path of regulation, which EU is in an advanced stage of. You're moving to kind of make a case that this is surveillance. So please curb on data sharing. You're trying to kind of curb the size of these companies. So in order to distract from the immediate thing, which will actually control the shape of AI and the harm that it can do, you are now changing the goalpost completely and making it some kind of a beast, which is actually just a product of having access to surveillance data, yours and mine and others, millions of others, and about these large companies. So I am really struck by that. So she says, sure, it's not rocket science to control or regulate AI, but we need to kind of get the frameworks right on that. So while I understand that when any timeline is drawn up, like Steve Jobs is like this great dada of science, of, you know, arts and science and all of that design, and he's changed the way the world works, the Apple phone, and seduced us all. A lot of us are Mac heads, can't use any other phone, etc. I think they are more kind of corporate, rather than some big ideas that they have pushed, or some big science or some big creativity geniuses. So I would like to make that distinction. I understand that Sam Altman would probably one day, in fact, he did this interview, now what's that? Let's say it. There's a very famous podcast they do in the States. It's a really long form podcast that Sam Altman, I said, was it Let's Say It? No. Yeah, but it's a pretty good one. I watched all of it. And what came through was, of course, like, no doubt, I mean, the guy's like so young and he's doing all this excellent stuff and all that. But he would come in that timeline where I would put Zuckerberg, not Oppenheimer.
Okay. Like, one or two does comments. It does make sense, but I completely disagree with everything you said.
As long as mine makes sense, yeah.
Like, even the Whitakers, I feel the Meredith Whitaker, is it? Like, her arguments also, I felt like, I don't know, it's like, I feel like she's not, I feel like she's not well versed with, like, the AI, AI alignment problems. Like, she's talking as if she's not familiar with those, so not very sure. Also, like, one final comment on the... One final comment on the... I feel like, in terms of, like, Steve Jobs and Zuckerberg, I feel... I will not hesitate to make an argument where I think the impact that maybe Steve and Mark, both of them have had on like humanity is probably equivalent to like the invention of the nuclear bomb. And I don't know, I really don't mind pushing it maybe more than that, because like the invention of the iPhone is probably one of the best inventions or one of the most significant inventions throughout human history. Like I cannot imagine like even this happening without the iPhone. And even Facebook and WhatsApp and Instagram that Mark runs, billions of people, billions of dollars of contribution to GDP. A lot of people make a living on these apps. Like I understand where it's coming from, but I feel both of these men have like significantly changed the trajectory of humankind. Like I understand, like
I'm interrupting here. You need to be careful here because no doubt Steve Jobs, we know where the mouse comes from. We know the history of the mouse with Jobs as kind of thing. He's taken that off someone, right? There are issues here. As far as WhatsApp goes, Mark Zuckerberg just bought it off other people who'd invented. WhatsApp's a brilliant invention. I want to shut down, but that's a different issue. So we need, that's my point. Both, that we need to be careful.
Both of those cases, no, both of those cases are irrelevant, right? Like even if Steve Jobs...
No, not irrelevant at all. There is a certain kind of entrepreneurial or whatever Silicon tech bro shit that they're there and they're able to kind of weld it. And he's married WhatsApp to Insta and that gives it a different power. But WhatsApp came from somewhere else. It would have just cleaned out Facebook and finished it. Insta came from somewhere else. So, you know, what I'm saying is I'm not kind of diminishing their importance as being critical, but I would put them on a different timeline. I would put them on a different timeline as I would Oppenheimer, though Christopher Nolan seems to agree with you. He thinks that the same horror of the bomb can be, is the kind of AI moment. That he's spoken of that in several interviews.
Correct.
I don't. I think I need to be more discerning here. I would strongly make my case, but I see where you're coming from.
Right. So I think difference of opinion, but we'll move on. I want to go back to, I want to bring it back to the editor discussion, which is, I'm curious about what you do, like in a sense, like on a daily schedule wise. If you can walk us through like a typical day, you know what, let's make, if you can maybe combine your personal schedule with your work schedule, that'll be more interesting, I feel. If you can walk us through like, as an editor also, like a typical day, what's it like, what meetings or how much of meetings or how much of, let's start with what time do you get up?
Like really early. You need to get up like really early. I wish I got up earlier than I do, but I don't have a fixed time depending on how the night has been. So I'm a fan of being able to get some sleeping in, but you know, by 7, you have to be like up and about. You have to be up and about by 7 on a bad day. Otherwise, I think like 6, you need to be like scouring papers, figuring out how the media world has seen. So I think I ideally target that by say about 8, I should be in a position to push stories to my team and to be in a position to lay the agenda for, you know, building that. This is what the newspapers say. This is what other news places say. America has been up and about. So in a sense, America is settling down. So, you know, globally what's happened, Japan, US, whatever, China is kind of active by then. So I think between 6 and 8 is like, it's like trying to just get everything kind of, it's a time when you're devoted to your coffee and your pushing stuff out, reading, scanning. In fact, even more than reading, I'm scanning. I start reading later. You have to just first scan, see, and kind of push it so that other people in my team can then start processing it, push it down the pipeline. And then I think we have like an early news meeting, say about 9:30 or something. But by then you're up and running, taking calls. People think it's, they can totally call you after 8 o'clock, 8 a.m. and all that. So they can totally call you. So, you know, all of that happens. And then by say 9:30, there's a meeting. And at 9:30, I finish the morning meeting by about 10. But no, my morning meeting is like really short unless there are some major issues to discuss. And then we get on to the business of like stories, revising, editing, meeting people, getting out to office, physically meeting people, and taking the day from there.
And I want to push this a little further. So you have a typical lunch timing or?
No, just a crazy lunch timing. So invariably now it's like a dabba. You carry a dabba. Some days you don't. I try and push some meetings to lunch so that you can discuss stuff in an hour lunch break. And
I'm so sorry, but so I'm just trying to understand this because I'm not very familiar with this world. And so I'll tell you where my surprise is stemming from, which is, let me look at if I can contrast your schedule, and I'm not trying to discount your schedule as well, but I'm just trying to understand it in the sense that if I can contrast that to the PM schedule,
That's a fair comparison. He sleeps only 2 hours a day. I don't. Works 22 hours, no?
Let's forget the Indian PM. Let's go to the, let's say, US president, US president schedule.
Unfair comparison. I protest. I'm not running no country.
So that's where I'm that's what I'm trying to understand. In the sense that I feel, okay, even if you remove those two, I'm trying to put you in a spot of let's not make this personal as well. Any editor position or with a CEO position or upper VP, any CXO position, generally, however busy they are, they generally have a decent lunch timing. And it seems even though there is a lot of things happening, that at least they have some time to have a decent lunch. In your case, that does not seem to be coming through, in the sense, I don't know if it's a communication problem or the day in itself is so
it's happening. Actually quite chaotic. Yeah, it's so chaotic. It's happening also. We don't have the structures of ensuring. I'd love to have lunch in time, but my lunchtime will shift from 1 to 1:30 to 2 to 2:30, depending on the day's events. I don't have those structures. A CEO or a VP and all will have this assistant, will have this cubicle, etc. Please understand, we're a very small, we're all independent websites working in a very difficult environment. We are 24/7. We don't have those structures to, madam, it's lunchtime kind of thing. Which say even the film industry swears by, because they'll stop all shooting and do lunch. I would respect lunchtime in the sense I would eat lunch. So I'm not saying I will not eat lunch, but lunch is not a marker of, at 1 o'clock, I'll stop everything and I go to my wife's house for whatever. I go to my home for lunch. So,
What caught my attention was when you mentioned, you'll try to get a quick lunch when you're also doing a meeting. I was like, man, that is
standard journalistic practice that, let's see, you meet over lunch. You'll eat lunch properly. I'm not saying that. I'll eat proper lunch. It'll have all components in it and all that. But it's not like a lunch is not a marker of, my day. So, of course, it is afternoon, because for others it is, right? I'll see you after lunch, or I'll come down at 2:30. So, on those times, I'll finish it. But there are times that I think also this wretched post-pandemic world has completely kind of, otherwise, I remember with the Express, etc. and all that. So, we'd all go down to lunch in our canteen. And we would eat lunch together, kind of thing. And that was 40 minutes short and all, but we'd all be eating lunch. Some would bring food, some would order from the thali, etc. You see? So I think all that has been destroyed, because we work in an office where for most people it's work from home. There's only the accounts people. There is only people who have to come to office who are coming. I, of course, make it a point to go there, because I think there's something to be said about the politics of presence. You need to be there. Somebody needs to be there in office for at least a large number of hours. So we're not, maybe it's a part of that also. But otherwise, I would not. I don't add too much romance to my lunch on a working day. Sometimes it's a dabba lunch goes. Lunches with me and I'll eat it. Sometimes he's not giving me lunch. My person who's he says I lunch nahi hai. Kind of thing. Okay. So I'll get a curry chawal or a rajma chawal, or say, yaar, tu lunch pe mil le mujhe. I'm going down for lunch. Come with me there. We'll discuss this problem over lunch. And I think that's very standard practice in my trade. I don't know about prime ministers and VPs, but that's very standard practice in our trade. No? Post-pandemic?
I am not aware. I mean, I don't know. What I am aware of, generally, I feel... What I'm most surprised by is the hustle that I see. Either I'm not in touch with any of these worlds and I'm making certain assumptions which are completely false.
There's a total hustle. No, you're absolutely right. You're being very perceptive and seeing that. It's quite kind of hustly, it's chaotic-y. There is no me time. In the times that one needs that kind of me time, or even time to just read, I like to read widely beyond just what may even concern The Wire or whatever, you know, my job, because that's my job, if you know what I mean, to be able to kind of absorb as much information on things which are not immediate concern. That funny four quadrant of what is important, urgent, not urgent, but important kind of thing. For that, then I have to tell my colleagues and say, guys, I'm not contactable now for the next 2 hours. And even my family knows that. That man, call me on this landline if you must, if there's a, you know, if somebody's been run over by a car. Otherwise, I'm on, you know, if somebody's arrested, run over by a car, call me on this. Otherwise, just leave me. And then I'll, you know, I'll either watch a film or I'll do something which is responsible for me. But then I have to like step away from that chaos, which is partly because of the way in which the information world is now, with stupid social media on a constant emergency, almost programmed triggers of pushing news in the way it is now. And anybody can reach you at any time. And I'm in that business of being a 24-hour website. It's not even as if I bring out a weekly newspaper or a book review journal. So that, no doubt, if there would be no hustle, there'd be no job. I would be a very bad editor if I was trying to introduce artificial kind of barriers and regions of calm in my day. They don't exist. And they shouldn't either. Actually, and that's the job.
Okay.
That may be a very bad way of conducting a business, but that's what it is.
I mean, I think there are arguments to be made from both sides. But since I'm not in the business, I'll just shut up.
No, you don't need to. I think it's important to know there are times when there's completely, you know, I took like 10 days off, you know, and I was not like looking at stuff. Somebody else was like, boss, the buck stops with you, karo. But for most of the times, I can't do that.
Let's move on to, now I'm curious about like, what time do you like, so there is no sign off. I mean, sign off is a, I'm using it loosely in the sense like what time do you generally, is there like a, let's say you, once you get home, like does your work stop at the office, or like once you get home also you're like 10 o'clock like typing stuff?
Yeah. Sometimes. I mean, there are times when it's quite peaceful, and there are times that I'm writing stories. So.
No sign off. Okay.
No, not really. Not that I'm working hard. Like I'm sleeping. I'm still working 22 hours. No, but there is no predictability to what it would be.
Okay.
If a reporter calls me or my desk says, "Yeah, please tell me this is about to go. This is, please take a look at this. I have to take." There's no like.
No, but on average, like, how many days does it happen? Like, let's say, like on in a week, let's say, how many days is that lifestyle?
News flow, like we were like completely rocked by our Sundays were destroyed when that Atiq Ahmed was killed and all of that was happening. That was chaotic. We had meetings all like morning. They were running here, there. So that it really, we're actually victims of the stupid news flow. So whatever chaos you see on the news happening, we are the like elves and kind of pixies and the nomads who are my team and all of us who are making that happen. No. So however horrible and chaotic it would be, that's the state of the information flow these days. And especially as we're going into elections and all that. It, not that we're doing election stuff, but that is generating a kind of a chaotic routine for news, which is there.
So I'm guessing you obviously work on Sundays as well.
Yeah, I mean, technically, no. So I feel a little rested. I do. I can read the Sunday magazine, print Hindu comfortably that day. I'll read FT Weekend comfortably. But yeah, I mean, if I have to work now, I have to like get on to doing stuff, making calls, making sure that some things happen. And if I don't do that, it's going to be very, very detrimental. So I'll have to do it. So yeah, I mean, I can't say my founding editors, me, we can't say that it's Sunday off air, Mera. No.
Okay. I'm curious about age in journalism. Like, let me contrast this to sports, maybe. So sports, my intuition is you peak at.
Why would you contrast it with sports? I'm sorry, your questions are your prerogative. But why would you contrast it with sport? Because sport contrasts with anything. Yeah, for heaven's sake. I mean, Alcaraz is 20. You're making a joke of the comparison. So I would urge you to reconsider. With sports, of course, the contrast would be crazy and unreal, no? Contrast with politics, with 30 years younger. Contrast it with the VPs, maybe, if you want to. Writers, cinema, I don't know. Why sport? Sport though would leave everybody behind. No, am I wrong? I mean, look at grandmasters and look at chess and look at whatever.
Let me ignore your commentary and still go ahead with the sports analogy, and I'll make my point, and you can maybe tell me where I'm going wrong. In the sense that the reason I chose sports is because most of them peak at a very young age, their most prominent work will be either in their mid-20s, and if you're talking about cricket or something, 30s, mid-30s, and then their career is like, they're not able to do significant work. Another analogy maybe I can think of is mathematicians, like people in math. Generally, most of their like groundbreaking work comes in their 30s, maybe. I think 30, 35, they do their prime work, and then their research papers, which are most cited, they fall off dramatically. So now you can comment on whether the analogy sucks, and then move on to whether is there a phenomenon like this in journalism where when you're young, you tend to do the most amazing stories, or because of your aggressiveness or your curiousness, you're able to go to places that others might not be able to have courage to go there. And as you age, you're more satisfied. Your kids have gone to, your kids are out of the house and you want to take it easy. And, you want a good retirement and you don't want to make a lot of enemies. So how do you think about this?
Actually, it's a very good question. Once I heard it out, because you're not exactly saying that, you're not contrasting with sports, but you're giving examples. So I think it's a very good question. I take back my earlier thing. I thought you were contrasting sports with journalism. So in sports, there are many things that go into sports. No, one is playing the sport. So which Federer also defies that, I mean, he was like, hello. So, okay. So I take your point that there is a certain level of peak physical fitness, which is physiological, driven by our boundaries, etc. So there is a particular time where you do things, even in math, which is very interesting. And they give the field medal, I think, only the prize, only at a younger age and all, point taken. Maybe journalism is kind of different. It's like writers and screenplay writers and all that. It's kind of more, even like musicians and dancers. It's not like necessarily only epiphany. I think actually more than even the creative wallahs. It's not epiphany. It's maybe, I mean, I don't want to say it's like wine is a big cliche, but maybe it's like you find rocks that change because there is sedimentation. There is, think of it like that, the layers are added on. This is different, where I would also contest the sports point, because what Gopinath can bring to sport is critical to sport, but he's doing it not as a player, he's a coach. So at different ages, or a number cruncher, in what the stats guys, the stats gurus, or the commentators, or those who watch and direct. So I think sports these days also is a much more composite kind of a business, where people at all ages kind of are cloves, they petal into it in a different way to form the bouquet. So no doubt the actual jumping, bounding and all is bound by age, and there is a peak thing. I think in journalism it's different. There is a certain freshness, a naivete, an enthusiasm and a natural energy that younger people bring to writing. No doubt that, and also you can do the maximum running around, egos are less, people know you less in a way that you, now of course there's this whole thing about face with photo, with journalism and all, earlier it was not that. You were a name or a voice or a representative of, we didn't even get bylines easy enough. You were just the Statesman or the Deccan Herald or whatever calling. So that affords you the luxury of being able to do good stories also. More people are talking to you and all if you're a youngster. So no doubt that is there. But I think there's a different kind of feel to the writing as people get to 30s, to their 30s. I've seen the same journalists evolve from their mid-20s. That whole energy and sharpness gets a little sandpapered, sometimes nicely so. Sometimes it's a curve and not a blunting. So I think we have to kind of be more discerning on that. Same thing happens at 40s, in your 50s. There are people who write excellent work when maybe they're 60 or 75. When they're able to put everything in perspective, if they have a reasonably good health, they're in a position to kind of draw a long arc, which is a fine piece of journalism. John Pilger would probably still do great work. So a lot of people would say he's jaded now. I wouldn't say he's jaded if he's able to like give a completely new kind of picture to what is going on. So I think with journalists, writers and documenters, really, that works differently. If it was like maybe an invention, Sam Altman, maybe by definition is young. Sam Altman would not be Sam Altman if he was older in that sense. So So I get that when it comes to an epiphanic moment or a moment. But I think here it's maybe just gets, in a lot of cases, it could get better with age. I'm not saying that's, that it always does or older people are better than younger ones. But I think it adds layers a maturing, which you may benefit from as the person grows older. So I think that's like a plus to journalism or documenting.
Like one thing when I think about age is like, this is a pessimistic view in a sense, like some people, like I feel generally people don't change their views after like a certain point. And in the sense that, so then like not a lot of growth happens and, you know, you keep parroting the same things. Yeah, same bullshit, same.
Look, yes, no, you're right. Calcification can totally happen. But I'm just taking the best case scenario, that age need not always be a bad thing. Speaking for myself, I have like radically changed my views on so many things with time, you know. So in my late 40s, I really changed my mind. I got thinking because the world was changing around me. And clearly, as I'm sure you know, it is at a different pivot the world is with everything. And so I'm taking my own example in that sense. And I've like changed dramatically over so many issues which I never thought I would think that way, but I do. You know, when it comes to maybe animal rights, my position on that has completely changed. Small, which may seem stupid, but you know, on just dogs, I could never stomach dogs. And I my whole view has changed completely over the past 2 years in ways that surprises me when it comes to kind of LGBTQ issues. My awareness is much more acute now and it's radically different from what it was even 10 years ago. So when I see myself, sure, sometimes it can just calcify and go, really, I've seen people go regress, really. But sometimes experience does keep open you for change because there are more facts coming in the, you know, in the way and more perspectives. But yeah, sometimes it can just push you into a corner and you just retard into some bludgeonhead moron.
Yeah, like I'm thinking of, you know, the best example I can think of is people who write like books on, let's say, I don't know, anything, like any ideology, generally, let's say communism or capitalism or, you know, pro-market. You will not see like, generally, you will not see like somebody writing about pro-market, 3 pro-market books and suddenly he's changed his mind and, you know, now he's completely on communism.
Unless you're like Warren Buffett or Stiglitz or George Soros. I mean, they've completely changed their mind about the market and money and philanthropy and all. So yeah, people do change that way. They do some. But yeah, they've got lots of money to change. Yeah, so it's like an unfair comparison.
One is, could you comment on the state of journalism today? And also, I mean, that's what we get for like final 5 minutes. Also, like, evolution of journalism that you've seen throughout your career, maybe, and where do you think it's at now? If you can speak to that in 2.5 minutes, because I have another question at 2.5.
Okay, so okay, 2.5 minutes. Both of these things you want me to address? Okay, so what I'll say is, the state of journalism today, the state has got into journalism. So, that, you know, it's like a good question, state of journalism. I think a legacy media or what established media faces right now in India, having boasted about the vibrancy of journalism and India has defied post-emergency Indian press and all that we put out. I think it's a shame when I'm looking at the majority of even print, forget TV, if I can comment on. It's actually quite laughable. People who travel here, whether they're scholars, diplomats and all in their hotels to India, they're alarmed when they switch on the TV and the TV news and they don't even know Hindi. They're just kind of hearing and watching the music that underlies. And also, I think that we're in a huge crisis. And this crisis actually is very real. It's not about just the crisis of the screen because, and this is where I'd like to answer your question on the evolution of journalism. Currently, journalism faces, and this has been ongoing for a while, but I think particularly the financial crisis of 2008 really broke its back, that it's facing a crisis on the technology front, with social media coming in, the relevance of the journalists is at stake. Why do I need, if a Mr. and Miss Citizen journalist will tell me what's happened, why do I need Seema or Rajdeep or anyone, any journalist to tell me what's happening? Please don't mediate for me. Get out of the room. You know, I'll do it myself. That crisis which has rocked revenues. It has a proper revenue. Times of India, there are newspapers, journals, magazines shutting down, pretty much like what's happening in the States. That has quickened in India. We thought that print will survive for longer because people have a fidelity to print and all that because of the smartphone and cheap data and then Jio. So that is rocked. The economic model of journalism is gone. They've not found anything better because of technology. The economy is doing really appallingly. So the margins on which the supplements or the whatever, you know, equivalent of people wanting to give more money to people telling stories, that is completely squeezed. There is no money that people have for journalism in that sense to give to journalists. The technology, economics, and the political social model for the state interference in terms of the ads being the only ones being given by the state has completely screwed it up for reasons of economy. And then we must understand that a lot of people who, the big legacy media houses, were calling themselves anti-establishment, but they essentially stood for a certain way in which India should be. This is the old world. And even if it's the Indian Express, and even if it's, you know, other newspapers, a big conglomerate, etc., they held certain ideological views. With that ideological view now being in power, it's very difficult for them to be anti-establishment or to do that. So I think it's an overall huge crisis that journalism finds itself in. Very quickly on how it's kind of changed through the 90s, as I hinted, it earlier was kind of a calling. It was something that you shared professions with Nehru, Gandhi, with a whole lot of other people. They were also scribes, right? They were journalists, they were writing editorials, they were in the business of persuasion. That social component got taken out as it became nicely commodified with the whole cricketification, Bollywood, entertainment, Ekta Kapoor serials, the whole context of the whole, if you like, the information pool or the common sense of what was news to be expected on TV. News also went down the infotainment route. All was doing very well, I think, till, and even with the Anna Hazare thing and all, you could pretend to be anti-establishment and all of that. But I think all that is like, so all that terrible stuff was happening before that, paid news and all. This is not something that the 2014 government invented. A lot of the rot in journalism had set in earlier itself, with higher salaries, with having to meet bigger demands of it industrializing. A profession which fundamentally, if you call yourself a pillar of democracy, you cannot be getting those salaries and functioning like that. You know, then you have to like set different set of rules. But because you couldn't do that, you were continuing down that road, that rot had already set in with, and now of course with corporate salaries.
Is it higher salaries or lower salaries?
Higher, huge salaries at the top and pittance for the young, because you became like any other stupid factory running that you were doing, and CEOs, big editors, chief editors, and all, we're drawing huge salaries.
What you compared get, to what mean, you're, isn't that justified? Yeah. I mean, they're getting that for the experience.
No, it's not justified. That's bullshit. I'm sorry, it's not justified at all. It's not justified because if you're going to go down that kind of route of thinking of yourself as just another business, then what's happening to just another business will happen to you. And then you're arrogating to yourself, I'm going to tell you how India should be run. Sorry, there's a cost to be doing that, right? So,
but if I can,
the ways and means of getting that money. What are the ways and means of getting that money? It'll be government ads. It will be
Oh no! If I can push back in the sense, but it is a business, right? I mean, if you look at
unfortunately, it shouldn't be. It is a business, no doubt. I agree with you, but it shouldn't be, right? I mean, of course, you need resources for anything. You need resources for even the revolution. You know, you need the kakori, whatever. So that apart, but to make it a business is like it's kind of brought journalism to this pass. It can't be a business.
I mean, okay, let's take that. But what is the alternative? Like, if it cannot be a business.
Well, that is a big struggle that, say, people in the Philippines face, people in India face, people in the UK face, you know, the Guardian model of the trusteeship, etc. So how do you like counter the Murdoch press? So maybe the counter is that you actually need good public broadcasters, which actually fix the field for you. And then you can have lots of people working where it would take less money to run good news stuff. But otherwise, you cannot function and do honest journalism if you're totally driven by business needs. You can't. It does. The numbers will push you into bullshit terrain.
No, but public also, it'll be funded by government, right? So there also, it's a huge conflict of
interest. Public is not funded by government. That's public money. So we have to find some way of doing that in the way the BBC did for many, many years before it got into this. It still is very, very independent. So don't confuse. It should not be the state broadcaster, but a public broadcaster. You have to find ways, like we argue for public sector, that it can't be like government sector. It has to be public genuinely, where you and I own it as well. And that transparency, that autonomy. I mean, I'm talking about very evolved governance structures, which should be able to, with regulator, with some new thinking, be able to cushion me from government. It's public, but it's not government.
Just final point on this, just to push back. The New York Times, I'm not claiming New York Times as like the epitome or like the the what is that, the example of journalism. But I think NYT is a public company. But if I look at like the Pulitzer Prize is won and general like public trust, maybe I think it's done pretty well.
It has done very well in the digital age. And they pushed back on Trump as well. He's the president of the US of A, and they would name him, and which our newspapers do not do. Yeah.
So for me, I'm really squirming to like give this example,
NYT is a very good example. I would support that example.
I think in the sense that I think at this point, like I don't think a lot of people respect the NYT, and I think there seems to be like a lot of backlash in terms of like. So one is that I think a lot of people feel that, at least I think me included, that it's gone a little too woke, and in the terms of like story selection, maybe I don't know.
I thought criticism was opposite. Is the criticism opposite, that it's like too much of kind of apology and it's giving too much space to the Trumpists?
Really, I thought they were very critical of Trump, and
doing a good job then. I mean, if we disagree on this, then NYT is doing well then. So, you know, they've been able to kind of annoy both sides. That's
no,
good.
So I agree with you. I agree with you that they are critical of Trump. I think the problem that a lot of people have, and if this is accurate, I sympathize with this, is that they're maybe not as critical to, let's say, Biden as proportionate to, let's say, Trump. So I think that may be a factor. And if that is true, then surely I think that's...
I don't agree with that, but I can see people holding that view, because actually they give a lot of play. Now the recent criticism of NYT is that they have to sack their opinions editor as well, that they're giving too much of unfettered play to the other side. Maybe they're responding to this criticism that they've gone soft and, you know, Hunter Biden, CD, all that nonsense. Why didn't you do those stories? So now they've actually gone down to, being actually giving too much play and too many paragraphs and too many brackets on... justifying the other side, but I find them broadly okay. They're good.
Right. So my broader point, whether people agree or disagree with the NYT, good or bad, is it's a public company, and it's a relative success. Yeah. So there, it seems to have worked out pretty well.
That's also like, it speaks of the environment in the US, though right now it's very like fraught and contested and all that. But that's what people say here now, that, you know, can we really, like what film stars say, that you'll burn my house down, yaar? Can I be all that independent? What's our society about? You have that stupid, Sena, which does not allow a film to go through, a fictional film to go through, right? When they went after Khilji's thing. Post-censorship, we have our society is like turning into mobs where they want to censor. So, I don't know if NYTs can't be possible in India unless we have the guardrails of... Ideally, I agree with you. Somewhere between Guardian, NYT, those models of public... Public, I mean like a group, trust, ownership, which is accountable, which is broadly transparent, is what we should work towards. But our political environment is like completely... I mean, you know, you can't say revolution. Your governments are telling you that you should be in jail because you didn't say peaceful revolution. So we're going through like a very, very difficult political time in which you have to situate even the economics of journalism.
I think finally, if there is any young person who wants to be a good journalist, what would you say to them?
What would I say to them? I would say like read really widely, read what good stuff all the time. Never lose your nose for that. Have a thick address book. Keep notes. I don't mean those notes. I mean notes. That always helps, because it is the most sophisticated technology, pen and paper. You can always, nobody can take it from you in terms of, you know, it doesn't crash. It just kind of tells you, follow up on stories and be really interested in stuff. So I remember, of course, now much is being made out of this tomato and lettuce story. One young journalist, a city reporter when I was resident editor in Express, she used to order food into office, and she noticed that McDonald's is not serving the lettuce leaf. And through that, she ran into a story on what was happening, city story, small story, about what was happening to lettuce, etc., production. So, I mean, that's the way to kind of think out of the box as much as possible. And there is no story which is a small story. Really, to kind of pay attention to people who talk to you, and to not just try and be as open-minded as possible, is what I would say.
Seema, thank you for your time.
Need light your ring. Okay, you just lit up, by the way. Yeah. Okay.
My door just opened because of the wind. Yeah.